And my sober date is June 12th, 1995. It's not when I came into the fellowship. I was introduced in 1987. That's a lot about what my story will be about. Thank you for asking me to come and speak tonight. Thanks to Chris and the alumni department, or this morning, I should say, to share my heart. That's what was written in the card that was left in my room, and it touched me because that's what we do. We share our heart, and I never knew how to do that. You know, Chris said this biker from New York, and you know that's the way I grew up, and sharing your heart was not what we did. We didn't really share anything. I see what comes out of here a lot is people who believe in being recovered. Or my home group, by the way, is in Long Beach, New York, the primary purpose group of Lynbrook. So come visit there, please. Where we come from, in our area, recovered is not a good word to mention. And here I see that it's, you know, the truth, that we can recover from this horrible disease. You know, it's a humble thing for us to say that our names and that we're alcoholic. And that's very humble. And I don't like that, really. I found it necessary that I have to introduce myself as a recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it is more humbling to just say that I'm an alcoholic. But there's two reasons that I always introduce myself when I speak as a recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one is to give new people hope that they don't hear much, that you can recover from alcoholism. And the other reason is to remind myself, because in 1987 when I came into AA, we read in How It Works at almost every meeting, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Well, in 87 I stayed around for a while and I wouldn't, so I couldn't. You know, I just didn't recover. As a matter of fact, I got sicker. In 1995, when I came back, I would and I did. You know, and it's that simple. You give yourself to this simple design for living, you get a God of your own understanding, and you get a completely psychic change. A new person is born. Life takes on new meaning. So it's important for us to give that hope that you can recover. I hate that there's a myth that, you know, we can't. I really do. So a little about myself. Very shy. This is a huge miracle up here besides the fact that I'm recovered from alcoholism. I speak, and I speak a lot. You know, I do a lot of big book studies. I speak at meetings. I share. From 87 to 95, people offered me $20 just to raise my hand and say my name in the meetings, and I wouldn't. There was no way that I was even getting my hand up to say my name. Now people will offer me $100 to shut up. you find God, you got to tell everybody about it. And that's just the way it is. So when I grew up in an area where there were apartment buildings. And looking out the window, I'd see the older people hanging out on the corner, drinking and getting high and having a good time. And those were my heroes. Those were the people that I wanted to be just like. I would look out the window and say, I want to be just like them. Guy that lived upstairs from me, Roger, OD'd from a heroin overdose, and I wanted to be just like him. You know, those were my heroes, people that lived that lifestyle. I don't know what was wrong with me. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I didn't think anything was wrong with me then. But it wasn't long, I'd say. You know, I'm bad with ages and numbers, and you know, I can't remember what I did yesterday, today, of sane, sound, sober mind. I don't remember much date-wise of what went on then. But it was about 12 years old that I started indulging and drinking on the corner with them, and I loved it. You know, I all of a sudden was able to feel a little okay about myself, and I loved to drink. I started going to school and drinking a little bit in school, and you know, looking forward to the weekends and going to little keg parties, and I just absolutely loved the alcohol and what it did for me. It was very difficult for me to make friends, and all I ever wanted to do was fit in. At all of these parties, I would always do something stupid. I would get in a fight with somebody, or I would wake up the next morning with my pants wet wherever the party was. I would always get into trouble, and the next day that I'd see these people, they would make fun of me for the things that I did or said or the condition that I was in, and all I wanted to do was fit in, you know. But I still loved what the alcohol was doing, because while I was doing it, I was feeling like I was fitting in. So I would just say, well, the next time that we do this, I'm not going to do anything stupid. I'm going to make it home on time, and that's not what would happen, you know. But I kept trying to do it right from an early age, and I didn't know I was doing it wrong. I was just thinking I still wasn't fitting in, because I just never felt like I fit in. Fifth grade, I was hanging out in the park instead of going into the school. I was with much older people, and school grades were going down, and they had the first of many meetings about Bart and the school, and they were going to leave me back, but my parents were moving, and they decided that they'd give me an opportunity at the new school that we were going to. So they promoted me, and you know, that whole summer I would ride my bicycle back to the old neighborhood and drink and hang out with the old friends, and I didn't meet anybody at this neighborhood that I was going to be going to school with new kids. And when school started, I got real scared. You know, now I'm walking into a school and I'm not going to know anybody, but I remembered what made me feel okay. So I'll just drink the first day of school and I'll be okay, and that's what I did. I, you know, just went to school every day with a little buzz, and I met the kids that were hanging around the wall and drinking and then hanging out in the bathroom doing stuff instead of going to class. And it didn't take long before I was getting into a whole lot of trouble in school. A lot of suspension hearings and meetings about me. And there was a woman that came from a drug and alcohol program. It was called Project 25. And she came once a week, I guess Wednesday or whatever it was. And they decided that I had to go see this woman once a week. And this woman, I'll never forget her name, she was really good to me. I mean, she really, really knew I had a problem. I believe she was one of us. And she would always tell me that if I didn't straighten out, if I kept coming to school drunk, if they found alcohol in my locker again, that they were going to pull me out of the school I was in, and I was going to have to go to the school she comes from full-time. And that was a huge threat, because to me that meant that I'd have to meet new friends all over again, and I didn't want that to happen. You know, because I knew it was very difficult for me to meet people. But I didn't want to quit drinking either, because I loved to drink. So I didn't, and eventually I ended up in Project 25. Project 25 really didn't put up with drinking at their program. They were real strict about it. And I started to progress and get a lot worse. I started to get arrested a lot for things that I was doing outside of school. My father worked very hard. He was very successful. I had a nice roof over my, you know, head and a nice home. My parents were divorced, but I had a nice home. And I never really wanted to stay there much. I would actually, thinking back, I would sleep in like elevator shafts in the buildings or whatever it took, because my mother was 120 pounds soaking wet, and I hated hurting her, but you know, I had a sister who died very young, and my mother would stand in front of the door and say, "You're killing yourself, I don't want to lose another child, please don't go out," and I would throw her away from the door, and I would go out to do my thing for a few days, and then come home eventually. So at Project 25, they started teaching her what she should do with me. They would start locking me up in shelters and reform schools, never quite treatment centers like this. They actually never really said that I was an alcoholic. They used to just tell me that I was a piece of garbage, I was never going to grow up to be anything, that I need to start paying attention, you know. So it's a lot of discipline. They used to tell me that if I just didn't drink, I'd probably be okay because I seem like I'm a good kid, but I don't seem to admit that I have a problem with it, and so they would discuss other emotional problems or whatever. So I never got better in any of these places, and I went to a lot of them. I remember going to shelters in Brooklyn, New York, and I would actually, they put me on pajama restrictions in these places. They would try to anyway, but as soon as they would mention it, because I wasn't even sleeping in my pajamas in these places, so as soon as they said that I was going to have to spend the whole day in them, I would jump out the window, I would go drink Night Train with the bums down in the corners, and then try to sneak back in. I did whatever it took to drink because I loved to drink. So in 1977, I think it was, I finally went away for 18 months to upstate New York. And at this place, they were telling me the same thing. If you just didn't drink, you'd be okay. And again, it had no depth and weight to me because I just knew if I just had a drink, I'd be okay. What you're saying to me really doesn't have any depth and weight. I'm sure that's not the language I was using, and I'm sure it wasn't good language to them. But I started to think to myself that maybe there is something to the way that I'm drinking and living my life as such a young kid. When I get out of this place, I'm going to go back and do the right thing. I'm going to get my life together. I'm going to go back to regular school, and I'm going to do okay. And I want to thank Ashley last night for speaking. I think that was her name. And she did a great job. And she reminded me of the way when we're young, we can come up. When she was talking about the amnesia, and I remember how many different doctors until I went to the head of neurology at Booth Memorial Hospital, because I had my parents convinced that I had narcolepsy, because I was doing certain other things for a little while, and I was falling asleep everywhere, and it lasted for a long time. Anyway, back to I was going to do the right thing. So I came home after 18 months and went to school for the first day, called into the dean's office, and the dean says to me, you know, we have your records here, we see what you're about, we don't want any trouble in this school. If you cause any trouble, you're out of the school. Well, I knew I wasn't going to be perfect, and I knew that something good was going to be happening. I was going to miss a day of school, something was going to happen. So I just got the attitude, you know, well, then I don't really want to be here. I called my father up, and at this time I really was pretty angry. I didn't have much of a good rapport with either one of my parents, you know. My mother would scream, lock him up, he's an animal. My father would come over and say, there's nothing I can do, your mother has custody. I really didn't have much of a rapport with them, but I decided to call my father and ask him that if he signed me out of school, and I had a good sales pitch, you know, I've been in reform schools and shelters for so many years that, like, I really don't know the schoolwork. Real school ended it by fifth grade, so I really don't know the schoolwork. I'm not going to do real good in it, but I could learn your business and, you know, come work for you if you just sign me out of school. So he said he would think about it and discuss it with his partners, and he did, and he called me up and he said that he would sign me out of school and I can come work for him. So the first day of work, I woke up that morning, and I was really happy. You know, I'm going to change my whole life around. You know, I'm going to be proud. I'm going to make my family proud. It was the week of my birthday. It was a cold New York October morning, and I was waiting for the bus to go to work to do the right thing. And a friend of mine came over, and he gave me a little birthday present, a little bottle of Jack Daniels, because I love Jack Daniels. And I put it in my coat, and I said, well, this weekend I'm going to celebrate my birthday and what I've done with myself now, and, you know, being a working man. But I started getting a little cold waiting for the bus. So I took a sip. Figured that would warm me up. And going to work, I got a little nervous on the bus ride. You know, how am I going to do this work thing? And, well, I finished that little bottle of Jack Daniels and got to work, and I knew exactly how to run the business and what everybody should do, and made a complete fool of myself, my father. That wasn't my intention when I woke up that morning. That was the first time in my life that I am convinced, you know, we talk about crossing this line. I don't know about if there's a line or not, because before that I always drank because I wanted a drink. This was the first time that I could remember that I drank and I really didn't want to. I woke up that morning with all the right intentions. And this continued for a lot of years. A lot of years. And it got worse. And you want to talk one-on-one, we could talk all about how much worse it got. But I spent a tremendous amount of years not wanting to drink and drinking anyway. Things I tried to not drink during those years. 20 years old, I married a 30-year-old detox nurse. I thought that would sober me up. Hated her. Didn't work. A lot of insane things to try and get sober, and it just kept getting worse. Actually, she would, you know, thinking back, that's about the first time, too, during that time that I actually did get introduced to AA. I was hanging out with all of her friends that she grew up with at a house that had a nickname. You know, if she would call up, you know, if any of my friends would call the house looking for me, she would say, you know, oh, he's just probably over at Heroin Haven. Just go over there. You could, any one person can go on a round trip to Hawaii and back on 1 week's worth of our empties. Nobody in the neighborhood walked on the same side of the street of this house. And we all owned motorcycles, and they all never left the house. They all were in that garage and never went anywhere. But one of the guys that was coming, that one of the brothers actually that owned this house, all of a sudden was showing up with new friends, and they were going in the garage and starting the bikes and taking off. And I started to get a little curious. I had been in a bike accident, and I would go over to Warren every once in a while and say, you know, where you been going? Oh, I'm just hanging out with these guys. And, no, you don't hang out and party with us anymore. And finally he told me that he decided he couldn't live like this anymore, and he's been going to AA, and he got sober. And I just went, oh, yeah, that's nice, you know, and went back and did my thing with everybody else. But one morning, I don't know what made me call him up and ask him what it's all about, this AA, but I called him and I asked him. He told me where there was a meeting that night, and that he wasn't going, but he said, you know, I'm sure, he knew the shape I was in, and he said, I'm sure, you know, I'll give you directions when you get there, they'll know you're new, they'll make you feel comfortable, just head over there. So I stressed it all day, and, you know, maintained all day, and I went there that night, and it was at a school, and I was standing and walking around and around and around the school. I got there early, I didn't know what to do with myself, and a guy came over to me and he said, are you here looking for the AA meeting? And I said, I am. And he said, come with me, I'm setting it up. So I walked in with him, and I really was just scared to death and not sure I really wanted to do this, and just followed him into the school and went to the room that the meeting was in. And he handed me a little blue card and he said, would you read this? And I said, sure. And I sat down, and that was the best thing that ever happened, because I got to sit down and just keep reading this blue card over and over and over, and I didn't have to look at anybody. And he just kept setting up, and people kept walking in, and, you know, I just kept sitting there staring at this card. And he started up the meeting, and he said, to read the preamble, we have Bart. And my heart dropped right out of my toes. I had no idea he meant read it out loud. And I spent the next, what felt like 3 days, what probably was 3 minutes, trying to figure out, how the hell am I going to get out of here and nobody's going to see me? Because if this is what this is all about, is reading shit in front of people, and, well, it ain't for me. So after a few minutes, I was able to look around and make my way out of the room, and I got lost in the school. And now I'm like, oh, man, I'm going to get arrested for trespassing. You know, they all look good. They're not going to believe that I'm, like, one of them. And I finally found my way back to the classroom that the meeting was in, and I leaned outside of the room, and I figured when everybody leaves, I'll just follow them and never come back. Well, the meeting ended, and I got surrounded by you guys. I mean, and they weren't letting me go home. I had to go back to the diner with them, and, you know, I don't know if that's what you do where you come from, but they do a lot of diner stuff in New York, and they made me go back to the diner with them and talk, and, you know, and it was fun. You know, I was feeling like I didn't fit in, and I didn't, but, you know, I kept going to the meetings with them, and, you know, I kind of got a sponsor, and, you know, we kind of went to the meetings, but we really hung outside the meetings and smoked cigarettes and made fun of the people that were in the meetings, and I really didn't get very involved, and, you know, my life was getting really miserable because I wasn't drinking or anything, and I was really getting miserable. And then I would grab you one-on-one and tell you how miserable I am, and the best answer that most of the guys I was meeting would be, why don't you go downstairs and share it? And my answer was, well, my problem's really not their business, and I really don't want to sit there and listen to theirs. So that was the best, you know, so I wasn't really getting much out of these meetings. I don't know why, but I wasn't. I did this for a long time. And I was getting worse and worse. I got divorced. I got remarried. I had a daughter. I had good jobs. I had, you know, if you look on paper, you know, a house, a family, good jobs until the boss didn't treat me right, and then I'd go find another good job. Because if I wasn't drinking, I was employable, I was likable, until you really got to know me and saw how miserable I was, and then you ran from me. And I started wishing for the end. You know, I knew that going back to what I was doing wasn't really a good answer, but neither was this dry life. And I really just wanted to blow my brains out. Started going to therapy and started going to all kinds of... Nothing was working. I was just out of my bird. A buddy of mine called me up one morning, and we had been sober for years together, and he had gone out, and he wanted to get sober. And he asked me if I would take him to a detox, and I said, absolutely. I'm glad you're finally coming back. Then he said, can we go into Brooklyn, because they're not going to give me anything tonight and I want to get right. And I said, I understand, absolutely. And he was getting out of the car, and I reached in my pocket and I said, why don't you get me some too? And then I woke up the next morning full of guilt, remorse, and shame, and had I just throw this time out the window. That's the only thing that was probably keeping me sober at the time, was my time and my own pride. I was miserable, but I was sober. And I knew that now that didn't work. And now what do I do? Because I really had a horrible time yesterday doing this. So what do I do now? I'm never going to do that again. I called my boss. I told him I wasn't feeling too good. Could I have an easy day at work? He gave me an easy day at work. And next morning I woke up. And you know what? Yesterday, 2 days ago, wasn't so bad. And I struggled with this back and forth and back and forth. And I wore out the rug in the apartment that I was living in, struggling. Should I go out today or shouldn't I? One morning I woke up and I was in a bodega that all the food was expired. And they wouldn't give me what I wanted. And I tried to tear the place up, and I'm lucky that they didn't cut me up and put me in a dumpster, but I was really pissed off. And in this rage, I went from point A to point B. I ended up back in a meeting with you guys. And I don't know how I don't remember driving there, but I went into this meeting, and there was a bunch of young people. It was a meeting I was never in a neighborhood that I never went to meetings. And a bunch of young guys there and girls, and they were laughing and having fun and asked me to go out to clubs in Manhattan with them, and they were serving liquor, and, you know, they were going to regular bars where bands were playing, and, you know, in these years that I was dry, anybody that came with me knew that it wasn't going to be long before I said, I got to get out of here, I'm uncomfortable, you know, and I would say, like, aren't you uncomfortable? My attitude was, well, they must not be as bad as me, because they could hang out here, but I'm uncomfortable, and they would just laugh and say, no, but we just live a new design for living, and we can go to these places and have fun and enjoy life. And one night, one of the guys was celebrating his year anniversary, and his sponsor was speaking for him, and he said he was a recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was talking about being happy, joyous, and free, and loving life, and he was just so full of life, and talking about God, and just, I turned around to this guy, Artie, and I said, that's your sponsor up there? It's speaking for you, right? And he said, yeah. I said, I think tonight you should find a new one. And he said, why? And I said, because I'm going to kill him. And he said, why? And I said, because he has no right to lie to us about that you can be so happy and be sober. And Artie smiled, and he said, I'm sure he'd love to talk to you. So they set up to talk the next day. And Eric was an older guy, and He wasn't really that sick yet, but he was scared of me. We'll put it that way. I was a lot bigger than him, and I showed up to his store, and the conversation went where we did a little shuffle. You know, every time I stepped towards him, he would step away from me. But he kept talking about himself for about 2 hours. He described what it was like and gave me all kinds of great war stories and started making me feel really comfortable. And after about 2 hours, I finally said to him, well, what do I got to do to be better? And then he grabbed me and he said, I'm glad you finally asked. And he wasn't scared anymore because he knew he had me. And he told me to just read the first 164 pages of Big Book and practice what's in them for the rest of my life to get a God of my understanding, and that I could have what he has. And I said, well, I never read a book in my life, so thanks anyway. And he grabbed me. Now he was really not scared of me because he knew he really had me. And he said, I'll tell you what, I'll read it to you. He said, the only stupid question is the one that you don't ask. Anything you identify to, let's talk. Anything you don't identify to, it's probably because they're going to describe some shit you've never done. So we'll just start doing it together. And you'll see your life change to be just like mine. So that's what we started to do. You know, we read that doctor's opinion, and I finally didn't think that you were a bunch of wise guys that just said, don't pick up the first one, you won't get drunk. That there really was a physical allergy. That's why I did those stupid things when I was a kid. You know, that's why the kids made fun of me because I didn't drink like them. You know, that's why I had a lot more than one. And it made sense, and I felt that relief. Then we continued to read that great book, and you know, there was a solution, and more about alcoholism, and it talked about the alcoholic mind, that having all of that knowledge about ourselves, that we can't pick up the first one, and we can't play back the tapes, that was true for me, and that scared me, because I knew I had that alcoholic mind, and I couldn't fix myself, and that the time that I can put together was only going to be temporary time if I was doing it like that. And that scared me. It was probably the first time I cried in a long time. It was probably definitely the first time I cried in front of another man. But it made me desperate. You know, I came to him with just a little bit of hope left, and reading that, I had absolutely no hope. He brought me that book, and him brought me to that absolute hopeless. You know, it was no longer knowledge about myself, but it was admitting to my innermost self, in my gut, that I was an alcoholic, that I was absolutely powerless, that I suffered from that spiritual malady, that I was never going to be able to fix myself, and that if I didn't find a power greater than myself, I was going to die. And it was going to be slow, and it was going to be painful, and I was going to take a lot of people down with me, because now I had a daughter. We were divorced from my second wife, but I still had a little girl. It didn't feel good. You know, it was as if the doctor just told me that I had a week to live, and you know, and that's the place that I had to get to really admit that's the innermost self. In my gut, I felt sick. I was willing to do anything. So with that, I believed that he believed, and all these young people at this group believed, and you know, I made that most important decision that we ever make in our entire life, to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understand him, that if it works for us, we will bear witness to all those that want to hear it, that God works, you know, through our own way of life, through our own problems, and them getting, you know, fixed or at least dealt with, you know, that God can take us through anything and show that to everybody. That was the most important decision I ever made in my entire life. And the God of that I understand, that's a funny story, because he had me say, well, you know, what is the God that you understand? And I said, you know, well, I really don't believe in God, but I believe that you believe. And he said, well, if you wanted a God, what kind of God would you want? And I said, well, how about a loving God? And he said, all right, let's look at that. You know, you got this wife that you're not sure if you want to stay married to, that you're divorcing. You got this girl that's 13 years younger than you that you're living with. You claim you love them both. Look at your idea of love. And I said, you're right, it's pretty warped. So God's not love. He said, no, he might be, but not your vision of love. Let's start from you don't know what God is. And I said, good idea. So that's how I started, you know, God of my understanding, and I don't understand. I really don't today either, but I know that God is everything to me. You know, I believe that none of us would be sitting here today if it wasn't for that God. You know, so he handed me that pen, and I wrote that inventory, and you know, the first of many, and shared all that I could with him, you know, and was definitely willing to have God remove all the things that blocked me from having this relationship. And we moved through those steps really quick, thank God, because I didn't have too many more sober breaths without a higher power in my life, that's for sure. Started that amends process, and you know, I was absolutely willing to make amends to everybody I had harmed, and that was pretty much, if I met you, I harmed you in some way, shape, or form. And I was willing to go searching. There was a lot of people I knew were going to be difficult, but I was willing. And I got real free in the eighth step. Those ninth step promises came true to me in the eighth step. I was able to look at everybody and not hide in shame anymore as soon as I became willing. And then I went out. The way I was looking at it was to set you free. You know, 'cause there was a lot of people that hated me. There was a lot of people that resented me. And I needed to try and work that out and show them some kind of God that I understood. And that's what the ninth step was about for me and still is. Practicing that prayer and meditation life, you know, and I went through a lot with that. I still do sometimes and search. And it's a great journey. You know, that's for me, 10, 11, you know, the disciplines and, you know, asking God when I'm angry. Like, I can't remember the last time that I got angry for a long period of time. You know, it felt real good a couple of weeks ago, I guess it was, right, Tara? We went to, it took us 5 hours to get home from an hour and a half trip because there was tons of traffic. And I was handling the traffic no problem. We had to stop off at my job, and they were supposed to leave a van because I leave for work on Monday morning at 5 o'clock to 5:30 in the morning, and the keys weren't in the van. And now I was getting a little upset. And so I walked away from the car, so Tara and my daughter and Tara's daughter wouldn't hear the conversation. And I was not talking friendly to my boss. And you know, what felt good was that when I got in the car and Tara's daughter said to Tara, I never heard anything more than the word shit out of bot. I can't believe, you know, that. And my daughter said, wow, it's been a long time since I've seen my dad that mad. You know, so we're not saints, but, you know, this works, because that was me every day, you know. So these 10 and 11, you know, pause when agitated or doubtful, it works. So my sponsor came to a meeting. I was a little less than 3 months sober, and he came back to that home group, and he was never there before, other than, you know, to speak at that anniversary. And he walked into the meeting with me, and you know, there was somebody speaking, and then they opened it up to anybody new. And there was a rehab that came into our home group, and there was a young, angry, 6'6", tattooed, no teeth kid, telling everybody in his share how much he hated us, how much he didn't want to be there, how he wanted to kill all of us. And my sponsor said, after the meeting, I want you to go up and try and sponsor that guy. I went, are you nuts? And he said, that's what's going to keep you sober. And I didn't believe him. He took out the big book and he said, you know, because I told him, what do I have to offer too, you know? And because it wasn't really that I was scared of him, but because of his size, I just didn't think he really wanted it. And that's not like the first happy candidate, you know, for me to sponsor. And he said he'd be good for you. And he showed me in a vision for you where it says you're just one man with this power in your hand, with this book in your hand, and you just tapped into a power greater than yourself. And you know what? That book hadn't lied to me yet. He hadn't lied to me yet. You people hadn't lied to me yet. So I had to believe that. And we visited and we talked in the parking lot and we read the first 164 pages together, and he stayed sober for about 3 years and worked with a lot of alcoholics, and a lot of them are sober today. He still struggles to come back. He decided he didn't want to live this design for living anymore. And I keep him in my prayers, and a lot of people do. And but that's what I've been doing ever since, is working with others, carrying this message however I can. My heroes are a lot different today. You know, I used to look out the window when I was a kid, and, you know, the guys that were standing on the corner were my heroes. You know, today you people are my heroes. Today, my sponsor who, you know, I look back, and he got real sick at the end, and he had diabetes. He was on kidney dialysis 3 times a week. But you know what? People still came to his house, and he read that big book to them from his bed. You know, he had the biggest ego in the world to the day he died, and we loved him for it. But, and he loved to speak, and, you know, we really couldn't get him to too many meetings, but we had started a new CA meeting, and they were having their 1 year anniversary, and it was his anniversary, and the group's anniversary was about the same time. And so what we did was we told him that we wanted him to speak for the group's anniversary, because we knew he wouldn't come have us speak, you know, for his anniversary. He wouldn't come to celebrate his anniversary. So we brought him down in a wheelchair, and he walked in, and he saw the room packed, and he said, "Wow, I can't believe all these people come to this meeting." And they kind of finally said, "No, Eric, we're here for your anniversary." And what they did at that anniversary was they said, "Anybody that's been sponsored by Eric, please stand up." And a few of us stood up. And then they said, "Anybody that's been sponsored by the people that just stood up, please stand up." And a few more people stood up. And then they said, "Anybody that's been sponsored by the people that just stood up, please stand up." And a bunch more people stood up. And that's until everybody except for, I think, one or two new people were the only ones that were sitting. And everybody that sits here today, same thing could happen with you. You know, that's where it starts. You get the message and you carry it, and somebody else carries it. And to watch that happen is something you just don't want to miss. You know, I mean, that's really what this is all about. And Don P, you know, that's a man who touched my heart more than anybody that I've ever known, directly, indirectly, and carried this message all the way to the end. You know, and those are people who had passion for this program that I don't ever want to lose. Like, I want that passion for my entire life. You know, I mean, I have a purpose in life today. You know, we all do. If we're given this design for living, it's a purpose for life. You know, if you're anything like me, you didn't have a purpose for life. So, you know, this design for living, there is no better. It's for anybody. It's absolutely the best thing going. I think that's all I got. Thanks.